But he tried to challenge the stranger. "Did a goggle bite off your manhood?" An insult like that, and his own combat fire would certainly have flared up.
"Why are you following us? Are the dwarves now worshippers of the Cordrian and want to return his offspring to him?"
"We demand you give us the cocoon you stole," answered Tungdil, motioning Boindil to desist from his next vocal onslaught.
"But I just made up such a good new insult," thought the latter ruefully. "Ah, well, I'll just have to save it for another occasion." "Too late," said the voice in the darkness. "We've got it. We need it, and we won't give it up."
"Then we'll come and take it," Tungdil drew Bloodthirster. "There's only 10 of you, and even though your footprints tell me you belong to our race, we shall not spare you." Silence ensued.
"We're not dwarves," said another voice just behind them, a voice out of the darkness as deep as the grave. "Not any more."
"Why can't I see them?" Boindil stared intently into the blackness until he thought he could make out a shape. Then, as if from nowhere, appeared the form of a warrior. He was the size of a dwarf, in the same armor as the dwarf hater they had come across in the Outer Lands. It was as if the passage itself had given birth to him. His helmet was closed, and in his right hand he held a Tionium spear with a long pointed end.
"That's an elf's weapon," growled
Ireheart, pushing in front of Slynn.
"It goes with the runes on your armor, you traitor! The thirdlings have gone too far. They can't be allowed to rule."
The dwarf came to a halt 2 paces away. Slynn was aiming the crossbow at him, Balindar covered the rest of the passage, and Tungdil rested his own weapon against his shoulder. Nothing in Tungdil's demeanor showed he felt fear, although both he and his companions knew themselves to be surrounded.
"You didn't listen to what I said, Boindil Doubleblade," said the stranger, lifting his visor. "We're no longer dwarves."
Ireheart inhaled sharply. At first he thought the dwarf had no face, but then he realized the blackness was the dye used for his beard.
"You still look like one to me," he responded. "Right, are you going to hand over the cocoon?"
The stranger laughed pleasantly now.
"I've stepped into your light, so you should reciprocate and come into the dark."
He lifted his left hand and clenched his fist. The torchlight suddenly went out, leaving only a dull red glow.
"Halfar tricks," Ireheart spat out, caught by surprise. "Vraka, strike them with your hammer. The skirt wearers have betrayed your creation."
There was a loud click when Slynn fired the crossbow. The sound of splintering wood told him his bolt had missed its target.
"We can see you as clearly as if you stood in the full light of day," the dwarf said to them. "When your torches light up again, don't move or we'll kill you."
The torches flared up. Ireheart cursed. He was flanked by 2 dwarves in black armor, and the blade of a curved dagger was at his throat. Another knife hovered by his eye. Again, he had neither heard his adversary's approach nor noticed a current of air.
"May Vraka's toss you in his furnace and burn your treacherous souls," he said contemptuously.
He couldn't see what effect his words had. The visor was still shut. Tungdil was surrounded by 3 of the armored foe and saw spears aiming at him. No one was trying to get very close.
"I'll ask you again. What do you want the embryo for?"
Their leader had not moved.
"To stuff it up your ass," was Ireheart's venomous reply. "Leave me enough room for my crow's beak, and I'll make you a bigger hole."
"Truth would be appropriate at this stage," said Tungdil surprisingly, "because I hope we can come to an agreement. Meeting dwarves, beings like yourselves here, and with the booty that was to be ours, makes me hopeful that the gods intended this."
He looked at the spear points that threatened his face, throat, and groin.
We wanted to steal the offspring of the Cordrian and bring them to Lotionon to provoke the monster to attack the Magus. Then a dwarf army would have set out to destroy the sorcerer, who would have been weakened by then. He studied the leader. You are heading east. I don't see any dragon emblems on you, so you don't belong to Loisbrand. I expect you had a similar plan to our own. You wanted to drive the Cordrian to attack the dragon, and then to take on the victor in battle, am I right? Their leader gave a smile of acknowledgement and nodded.
You are indeed, Tungdil Goldhand.
Who are you working for? For the Alfar? Do they want to take over the west and north of Girdlegard, like they did in the east? Tungdil remained as calm as a rock, as if it were he who had the upper hand.
That's none of your business. But I have a suggestion to make to you. Keep your suggestions, growled Ironheart, wondering in which order he should attack his guards.
He worked out a strategy that would free him.
Brave Vrakus, you traitors will see what a warrior like me is made of.
Go ahead. Anything that prevents unnecessary bloodshed will be accepted gladly, replied Tungdil. Astonished and indignant, Ironheart heard his friend giving in.
But not by me, scholar, he contradicted. These are our deadly enemies, murderers and traitors, because they're with the Alfar.
Tungdil's gaze silenced him. He looked round at the others, but Slynn was shuffling his feet, and Balindar was chewing his own cheek. Nobody spoke up in support. The spears were withdrawn, and Tungdil went a few paces further into the passage to discuss things, away from his party. Ironheart caught the words of the first few sentences the two exchanged, but did not understand the content. The sound was familiar, but it took him some time before his mind registered what his heart had rejected as a possibility. They were speaking the Alfar tongue.
The very last thing you'd expect.
Charming, said Slynn, annoyed. Our High King goes over to talk to dwarves who don't want to be dwarves, thinking instead that they are really vertically challenged Alfar. He turned to look at his captors. Might we learn what you call yourselves? No answer was forthcoming. Balindar uttered a curse.
What shall we do, Boindil? How should I know? I'm a warrior, not a thinker.
Ironheart's muscles tensed almost imperceptibly, but the blade at his throat was pressed closer. His guards were on the ball.
Yes, all right, I won't move, he said to appease them.
He watched Tungdil and the other dwarf talking. After a long time, to Ironheart it seemed endless, Tungdil and the leader returned. At a signal from the stranger, the guards lowered their weapons and moved behind their commander. Tungdil came to Ironheart's side.
We have won ourselves some new friends, he announced, as if it were the most normal thing in the world. If you would care to introduce yourself to my companions, he suggested, replacing Bloodthirster in its sheath.
The dwarf nodded.
I am Boscalin, the satrap of the Zadar. The Zadar is an Alfar word that means the invisible ones. Satrap just means commander.
His left arm described a semicircle.
These are my 10 best Zadar, and the rest are waiting at a secret place for our return. To explain why we're here, I'll need to go into more detail. There's no time for that. What about our companions out there on the plain? Said Ironheart sharply. We have to help them against the Cordrian.
With an angry glance at Tungdil, he added,
Maybe our new friends could give us a hand and show us what they're worth.
Boscalin shook his head.
They're dead, Boindil. The Cordrian wiped them out. One of my invisible Zadar placed at the cave entrance told me that before I showed myself to you. It was wise of you to follow us into the tunnel.
Balindar gasped. Dead?
The Cordrian caught them on the plain. How could they have escaped his white fire?
Boscalin nodded down the passage.
We should talk about it later, and put a few miles between us and the beast for now. It will follow our scent.
Ireheart looked first at Slynn and Balindar, and then at Tungil.
And where do we go now?
He had been thinking the scholar would answer, but it was the Cytrop who said,
To the south, to the Red Mountains.
How did the scholar do that? Ireheart had not expected this, and to judge by the astounded faces of Slynn and Balindar, they had not reckoned with it either. But he felt no relief. Nor was he relieved when they were shown something he assumed to be the cocoon, which the Zadar had hidden under a thick pile of warm furs and dragged along the passage on a shield on rollers. Gerdlegard, dwarf realm of the Fifthlings, in the north of the grey range of mountains, late winter, 6491st to 6492nd solar cycles. Indistinguishable one from another and vaguely ominous in their identical armour, the Zadar marched swiftly in the company of the surviving members of the Fourthling and Fifthling band. They had fastened the cocoon and their equipment and provisions onto a shield and were pulling it along.
How did you talk them into cooperating, scholar?
Asked Boindil as they went. We'll have to keep an eye on them, Balindar chipped in. And more important still, what do they want in exchange? Slynn looked around. I shan't be able to sleep. I can feel it in my bones. Not one of them has shown us his face, except for Baskalin. You'll be told next time we stop. It's better if you hear it from him. Tungdil placated them, then moved on quickly to catch up with the commander. They're chatting again, like old friends. Slynn nudged Balindar and pointed toward Tungdil's back, indicating a particular rune. The Zadar have got the same one on their armor, he mouthed. You know what? I bet it's no coincidence that we've teamed up. The plan about the nest was Tungdil's. Perhaps these are his warriors and are just pretending to be Zadar.
Maybe you're right, said the Fifthling pensively. Stop that nonsense, commanded Ireheart, in the uncomfortable knowledge that he could not tell them what to do.
Balindar looked at him disapprovingly.
You keep changing your ideas, Boindil Doubleblade. One minute you're on his side, then you start to wobble, then you change your mind again.
He stuck his hands in his belt.
You'll have to come to a decision. When it's all over.
Ireheart was angry.
We've got a job to do, and we'll do it, and it doesn't matter who helps us as long as it serves Gerdlegard, he said, avoiding the issue. There have been losses. Now we have new soldiers, and we have the Cordrians young.
He's right, said Slynn. We're better off like this than being a pile of ash out on the plain, or devoured by the monster.
He fell silent. When they came to a cave with a water source, Tungdil signalled to the company to halt, and Baskalin complied.
It's pretty clear which of them gives the orders, commented Ireheart, bursting with curiosity.
He, Slynn, and Balindar settled down away from the Zadar to eat.
I want to know what the story is with these Zadar. Fracas can't be giving his blessing to this.
He glanced at his friend, who was talking to the Cytrop. They were studying a map that they had unrolled and spread out, each running their fingers over the lines. Eventually they seemed to have finished and came over. Baskalin sat down on a boulder.
I owe you an explanation about myself and the Zadar, he began.
He released his helmet strap, revealing a shaved skull dyed black.
As I was saying, we used to be Thirdlings. Each of us is more than 400 cycles old, and we're all excellent warriors. When Aphaton and his southern Alphar marched in, and it became clear no one could stop them, our king suggested a pact. To our astonishment, they agreed.
His gaze wandered over the dwarf faces.
After about 20 cycles, the Jonna clan made us an offer. They were looking for volunteers to train up and learn certain crafts. In exchange, it was arranged that this particular unit would eliminate all the dwarf tribes of Gerdlegard. May Vraka shove a red-hot hammer through their stupid ears.
Ihart took a swig from his flask. They wanted Gerdlegard naked, without a single defender. Balandar's expression darkened. It would have meant the end.
The Alfar from the south are different from those in the sagas?
Slynn wondered.
Baskelin confirmed this with a nod.
They are wilder, more cruel.
Ihart laughed.
Am I hearing all right? More cruel, how could that be?
It can be, Boindil, answered a subdued Tungbil. Believe me, it can.
They aren't the only ones. A few hundred Alfar from the north have somehow managed to enter Gerdlegard without Aphaton's help. He's known as Emperor among the southern Alfar,
Baskelin continued his report.
It was the Jon Aklan who aided the northerners.
Boindil turned to Balandar.
How did they get past you?
They didn't, insisted the Fifthling. We keep the stone gate and nothing got through. It's nonsense. Baskelin threw him a disapproving look.
They got into Gerdlegard without your knowledge. The dwarves couldn't have stopped them. The Alfar rediscovered an old passage they had used many cycles ago to invade the elf realm Lesintiel.
By fracas! Then we must find the entrance and close it up.
Slynn looked at Ihart.
There's no point in keeping up the fortresses, otherwise.
The passage no longer exists. It collapsed, and it's underwater now.
The satrap folded his hands.
In any case, there's conflict now among the Alfar. The Jon Aklan and their followers consider themselves to be the rightful successors to the Unslayables, and as such, morally and in every way superior to their cousins from the south. The Northerners were the ones we had an alliance with.
The satrap grinned maliciously.
I'm sure they would have sent us to fight the southern Alfar sooner or later. I'd bet anything.
Well, well,
Ihart stroked his beard.
That's useful to know. So the Black Eyes don't like each other.
The Southerners are in the majority and they've taken over Jon Balsur and the former elf realm of Al'Andur. The northern Alfar have rebuilt the city of Jon in an artificial crater in the former elf realm of Lesintiel, now renamed Jon Bahara, the true Jon. Yours, Tungdil Goldhand, is a name they pronounce with hatred. They haven't forgotten that it was you who sent the city of the Unslayables up in flames.
Baskelin looked round at the others.
They taught us everything and trained us in their arts and skills.
How? Dwarves and magic? What's more, magic originating from our oldest and most terrible foes?
Balandar cut himself a piece of ham.
It was a long and painful process involving many gruesome rituals,
Baskelin explains, seeming distressed.
It felt as if they had burned out the very souls that Vraka's endowed us with. What you see is the outer shell, filled with something that would make you shudder with fear if you ever caught sight of it.
Boindil glanced at Tungdil and remembered the vicious scars covering his torso. Perhaps he had also undergone that transformation. Is that why his face had the fine black Alfar-like lines? Baskelin cleared his throat. His voice had gone, and he needed something to drink before he could continue his story.
After 100 cycles in their service, the Jon Aklan considered us to be loyal followers.
He looked at Slynn.
We spied on your strongholds and killed anyone in our path. I could find my way through Goldfast and Silverfast blindfold. There are no secrets. If we wanted to,
he lowered his voice,
we could lead the Alfar or the Thirdlings straight into the Fourthling realm. You wouldn't be able to stop us.
The Fourthling gulped.
That's impossible.
Baskelin pointed to Tungdil and Boindil.
Ask them. they came across one of my Sardar in the Outer Lands. He had been traveling through the Brown Mountains, on a reconnaissance mission through your territory. Then he was going to spy out Evil Dam and follow up the rumors about the return of the greatest dwarf hero.
He laughed.
He reported the rumors had been correct. He only just managed to escape from you.
Ironheart spluttered and spat out his drink.
He survived the White Death? We're tough.
Baskelin smiled mysteriously. And they sent you to steal the cocoons? Balindur had not taken his eyes off the satrap.
Yes. The Alpha, the Jean Aklan, want to stir up a war in the West to further their own plans. A diversion only. That's purely my interpretation, of course.
Baskelin looked at Ironheart.
Emperor Aphaton is preparing for a campaign against Lot Ionan. He intends to march to the south to overthrow the Magus and his Famuli. Then he will open the High Pass to allow more Alpha through.
That's good news!
Slynn filled his pipe. We don't need to start any wars. Let the two of them sort things out between them, and we'll hang around and see who wins. Let's kill the Cordrians young and bide our time. Balindar placed his fingertips together thoughtfully.
I thought our own plan was better.
He addressed Baskelin. I want to know the reason you and I are sitting peaceably next to each other instead of fighting. You are working for our enemies, but you're still ready to help us take the cocoon to Lot Ionan?
Treachery,
Tungdil said calmly. The Sardar never obeyed wholeheartedly, but have been waiting for an opportunity to change sides.
That's right,
Baskelin nodded.
Tungdil Goldhand is a Thirdling. A lot has changed in the Thirdling's way of thinking. And the dwarf laughed at for many cycles has become our greatest hero. He stood alone to fight against immense odds, and now he is the High King of all the dwarf tribes. Who else could we follow with both our head and our heart? We have been waiting for so many cycles to eliminate the Alpha, to destroy them with their own weapons and arts.
That was what you planned when you volunteered?
Ironheart stared at the satrap, finding it hard to grasp the immensity of what they had taken on.
By Vrakus, quite a sacrifice.
If what he says is true. Balindar sounded less than convinced.
I believe him.
Slynn nodded and chewed on the stem of his pipe. Baskelin smiled, a row of white teeth shining in the dark face.
To follow Tungdil Goldhand, and help to free Girdlegard. That was always our intention. And now we have the opportunity, we'll be able to carry out that plan.
He indicated his 9 companions.
Altogether, there are 23 of us.
Balindar's laughter was ironic.
That's plenty to make the Alpha run off, tails between their legs.
Now, for the first time, the commander of the Sardar showed impatience.
Each one of us can deal with 20 opponents without exertion, in conventional combat. But if we use our special powers, we can confound a small army. Let me tell you, Balindar Steelfinger of the Clan of the Steelfingers. If you thought the only thing our Alpha skills are good for is to put the lights out, you've got another thing coming.
He scowled.
I've walked past you 5 dozen times during the course of your life, and you never knew. I stood at your cradle. I stood at your bed while you slept. The Grey Mountains hold no secrets for me or my Sardar.
His hand lay on the handle of his curved dagger.
You have me to thank for the fact I didn't lead the Thirdlings into your mother's kingdom. The strongholds would have fallen as well.
He stood up and came over to the Fifthling to speak low into his ear.
I know all your secrets,
heir apparent to the Fithling crown," he whispered, then straightened up.
"So you are in the best of hands. It is an honor for us to be able to serve the High King."
Balindar sat thunderstruck. He had turned as pale as a linen shirt. Tungdil shook hands with Baskalin, who returned to his Zadar troops. The two groups of warriors bedded down for the night in separate corners of the cave. Ironheart could not understand why Balindar was suddenly monosyllabic, but he was still mulling over what the satrap had reported.
"Vrakus, now I'm positive that it was your work. Letting us meet the Zadar warrior in the mountains, I thank you," he prayed quietly. "Now, grant victory to the invisibles and ourselves. I would give anything to hear dwarves and humans able to laugh again."
"Would you give your life?"
Slynn asked, having overheard.
"Would you die for the cause?"
He turned over and put his hands behind his head, his pipe clamped in the corner of his mouth.
"I would, but only if at least one of us survives to report our heroic deeds. Otherwise, even the most glorious of deaths is a waste of time."
Ironheart wanted to reply, but his throat had gone dry. Perhaps it was better not to answer. He might have said the wrong thing. Gerdlegard, Protectorate of Goregar, 20 miles south of the Grey Mountains, late winter, 6,491st to 6,492nd solar cycles. Ironheart was feeling uneasy. They had taken off his chainmail and any clothing that had been in contact with the cocoon and had tied it to a horse bought for the purpose, in order to duplicate the scent trails and keep the Cordrian busy. As soon as the beast found the horse and consumed it, iron rings, shirt, hose and all, it would know it should have followed the other track. Ironheart was wearing random cast-offs that his companions could spare.
"I feel like some ragged peddler," he said down in the dumps.
"And what is wrong with my trousers?"
asked their crossbow specialist with a grin.
"If you burst the seams with your fat ass, you'll have to buy me some new ones."
"It's not fat. It's all muscle. You fourthlings don't have any. Your trousers would just about fit our children."
Ironheart looked back at Balindar, who was holding the Alfar dagger they had taken off the dead archer. He turned the weapon, running his fingers over the blade, and then struck it at a certain angle against his forearm protectors. It was not a strong blow, but the blade sang out and snapped in two.
"As I thought," muttered the Fithling, discarding the useless weapon.
"What did you think?" asked Ironheart.
And Balindar gave a jerk. He had not known he was being observed.
"That the dagger was faulty?"
"Yes. Something was wrong, I didn't know what."
He tried to explain. "We firstlings have a good eye for metalcraft. I knew a dwarf had made it, but something wasn't right. The smith had included a fine layer of a hard, brittle metal. It hadn't fused to the steel, and I could see that if subjected to stress, for example in combat, the blade would break off." Balindar looked at Ironheart. "It was constructed deliberately as an inferior piece of work. It wasn't a mistake."
"So, the Thirdlings are sabotaging the Black Eye's plans too, like the Zadar," noted Boindil with satisfaction.
"Well, I wouldn't go that far. It could be a single dwarf with a conscience."
The Fithling dampened Ironheart's enthusiasm.
"If there were a lot of this treachery going on, even the Alfar would notice and there'd be consequences for the Thirdlings. Fatal consequences."
He looked at Tungdil, who was up front at the Zadar commander's side, climbing the next slope.
"The Thirdlings may be good warriors, better than all of us, but they can't win against the Alfar. The Black Eyes have far superior numbers."
"It's a bit early to be seeing them as allies on the strength of one faulty dagger,"
Ironheart agreed. He looked up, surprised at the swift approach of a cloud. When Slynn followed his gaze, His arm shot up into the air.
Cordrian! To the north!
Ireheart was angry with himself that he had not seen it.
I think I must be getting old.
They dived for cover among the rocks, while Ireheart raced off to tell Tungdil.
What do we do, scholar?
The one-eyed dwarf stood straight and unruffled, his right hand shielding his brow as he scanned the sky.
It's closer than we'd want. Our trick with the false trail isn't working any more.
Boindil was sulking.
So I lost my clothes and armor for nothing?
It's given us a good head start, but that seems to be over.
Tungdil spotted the Cordrian between the clouds.
He's keeping a lookout. It won't take him long to spot us.
That means we'll never make it to Lot Ionan, scholar.
Precisely.
Tungdil looked back over his shoulder.
But we can take our gift to someone else. We've got to use the opportunity to cause our enemies maximum damage.
Ireheart recognized where they were heading.
John Barra?
It would be the safest. The path will be downhill most of the way and our sledges will help. And there'll be caves we can hide in when the Cordrian gets too close.
Tungdil looked at Baskelin, who nodded in agreement.
That sounds like fun. Slipping in unnoticed among the Black Eyes, what a challenge.
Ireheart signalled to Slynn and Balindar to come over. The Invisibles left their hiding places and began pushing the sledges uphill.
I don't intend to slip in unnoticed, said Tungdil. It wouldn't work anyway. I'll introduce myself as a transformed Tungdil, whose greatest wish is to wipe out dwarfdom completely. I'll offer the Alpha my assistance. We'll offload the baby Cordrian secretly and wait to see what happens. We'll have an alternative plan ready.
He looked at his friend.
Ireheart, you, Balindar and Slynn will have to wear Zadar armor.
Charming,
was the unhappy Fourthling's comment.
Don't worry, they'll have something in your size, joked Ireheart. One of their women's outfits.
Balindar put his hands on his hips.
I don't like it.
You don't have to like it. I'm your High King, so you'll do what I say. Tungdil sounded extraordinarily calm and determined.
The Cordrian is too fast for us, and you can't argue with me on that score. If there's a chance to deploy the embryo against the enemy, we'll do it.
He swung himself onto one of the sledges.
We'll be in John Barra in a couple of orbits. Follow me.
He pushed off and sailed down the slope. The Zadar followed him one by one, racing downhill. Slynn and Ireheart prepared to do likewise. But Balindar was standing next to his sledge, staring at the others.
I don't know if we're doing the right thing here, Boindil Doubleblade, he said broodingly.
The stories they write about us will show whether it was right or not, Balindar,
Ireheart said in consolation.
I don't know the answer, and I'm sure the scholar doesn't know either yet. Our plan is up the spout, and we've got to make the best of things. With the help of Rakus, perhaps we will achieve more than we think.
He patted him on the shoulder.
Trust your father.
The words had already left his lips before Ireheart realized what he had said. Balindar slowly turned to face him.
What idiocy are you babbling?
Boindil gave a forced laugh.
Ha! A joke! To cheer you up a bit!
Then it didn't work. Not with that joke. To Ireheart's great relief, the Fifthling went off to his sledge and started to push it.
Don't you know a better one?
What about the one where an orc asks a dwarf the way?
Balindar made a dismissive gesture.
Boring! Every dwarf knows that one.
But not my version,
Ireheart replied proudly and took a deep breath.
An orc comes along and sees a dwarf, and he wants to know...
Horseman!
Slynn called excitedly.
Down there, to the right of the sledges in the little valley. They're heading straight for the Zadar.
Why does he always see the danger before I do?
Ireheart looked where Slynn had pointed. Balindar tried to calculate how many riders there were.
The Black Squadron,
he exclaimed in consternation, launching himself onto his sledge on his stomach. "Quick! We've got to catch the others up and warn them!" He raced off. Slynn did not wait to be told twice. He zoomed down the slope in the same daring pose.
"Hey! Hey! Wait for me!"
Iohart pushed his sledge off, ran alongside it a few paces, then jumped on.
"By Vrakus! How am I ever supposed to tell a joke properly?"
Chapter 13. Girdlegard, Black Abyss, Fortress Evil Dam, Late Winter, 6491st to 6492nd solar cycles. Goda contemplated the pulsating edges of the flickering red dome close to the walls of Evil Dam. The sight reminded her of waves lapping, and she knew that, as with the sea, terrible monsters were lying in wait under the surface. She knew why the dwarf race feared deep water. Troubled, the Maga pulled her cloak tighter round her shoulders. The energy sphere now reached all the way to their stone walls, but she was powerless to affect its growth. Kiras, in breastplate and limb protectors over thick clothing, was at her side. Using a telescope, she watched the enemy's newly erected protective barrier.
"The walls haven't been damaged. I can't see any cracks or bulges. The red glow doesn't seem to be harming the stone. The warriors feared the force might bring down Evil Dam, but that's not happening. But the monsters can come directly up to our fortress walls. That is bad. I'll need something to shrink the sphere down again."
Goda's right hand played with the diamond splinters in her pocket.
"But what?"
"He killed them," said Kiras firmly, addressing the Maga.
Goda knew exactly what the undergroundling was referring to.
"I know. Iohart saw the injuries on the Ibariu too," she replied after a while.
When the two women stood side by side, it was obvious how different their respective dwarf races were. Kiras, taller and slimmer in stature, was almost like a small human. Goda, in contrast, was one of Girdlegard's archetypal thick-set dwarves. Kiras did not have the darkish fluff on the cheeks that was noticeable on Goda's round face.
"But Boindil said nothing."
Kiras could discern monsters behind the red screen, running across the plain round the Black Abyss and marking certain places out with flags.
"And he never will. Unless the dwarf pretending to be Tungdil Goldhand finally admits that he is an impostor."
Their attempt to force his hand had failed. Goda looked both ways along the battlements. They were manned at all times, the catapult teams at their stations, ready to take immediate action if the Fians attacked.
"That'll never happen. Those dead soldiers we found are evidence that he's pursuing his own ends with every conceivable means."
Kiras lowered the telescope to look at Goda. A flash caught her eye, and when she turned in its direction, she saw that it came from the eastern battlements. One of the guards had polished his shield so well that it was dazzling her. She thought she could even feel the heat of the reflection it sent.
"Is it true they've made him High King?"
The Maga nodded.
"And I thank Vrakus that I'm here in Evil Dam. This way I'm not subject to his commands."
The undergroundling leaned against the parapet.
"I wonder what happened to the real Tungdil. Dead? Captive? Or has he become something even worse than this thing? This fraud calling himself the hero?"
Goda sighed. "There's no way of knowing." Kiras suddenly brightened up and looked across at the red sphere.
"What if we captured one of the monsters for interrogation? Can't you make a hole in the screen big enough for me and a few Ubariu?"
Goda found the idea ridiculous at first, but on reflection,
"Why didn't I think of that?" "Because you've got too much to think about. You have to command the fortress and be our Maga, constantly on guard against sorcery."
Kiras offered this excuse with a smile, grasping Goda's hands.
"I don't tell you this often enough. You are like a mother to me. I can never thank you enough for what you have done for me." That's why I shan't find it easy to send you in there. Not only because of the monsters. There's a Magus over there as well. And who knows how long I'll be able to hold the opening for you.
Goda shook her head.
No. We'll drop that idea.
A fanfare sounded, drawing their attention to the scene. The women picked up their telescopes. A variety of creatures were running around, busy as ants, dragging stones to the places marked with penance and building protective walls. Judging from the speed they were working at, they had to be trying to get things completed by nightfall. Elsewhere, large fat creatures with broad long-taloned paws were digging furiously. As soon as the holes had reached a certain depth, they motioned over other workers to bring tubs of molten metal to tip in. Then long iron spikes were set at angles into the cooling substance.
They're making fixtures for siege machines, Kiras surveyed the scene through her telescope. Catapults, I'd say. Like the one I destroyed that they were using down in the ravine.
Goda summoned one of the Ubariu and asked his opinion. He agreed with her. While they spoke, other beasts raced up behind the screen, dozens of them dragging huge long timbers. One of the fat monsters supervised their orderly construction and, bit by bit, the confused heap of wood became a siege tower.
You are right, said the Mager to Kiras. And over there they're making an undercarriage for a battering ram.
She called for two of her children, Sander and Bandal, who she had been training up in magic skills.
We can't wait any longer. The magic sphere must be held back before those machines can reach our walls.
Kira stared.
What are they doing?
Goda looked down. The monsters had half erected the first four siege towers and then switched to the task of carrying stone blocks over and placing them on the wooden platforms. Other workers brought long coils of rope, one end of which dangled back down into the ravine.
Weights, decided the undergroundling. I don't know what they're for yet, but they look like counterweights.
They'll be putting up a bigger catapult in the ravine itself, I suppose, said the Ubari soldier, screwing up his pink eyes to see better. One of the beasts has got a white flag. He's coming up to the gate.
Goda assumed it was a herald come to negotiate. If it had not been for the barrier and the enemy Magus, she would have nailed the creature to the ground with a rain of arrows, then buried it under a rock the size of a house so that the brood of Teon could see what the dwarves had in store for all of them. But in the present situation, this seemed unwise. Negotiations, even if Goda did not intend to put the results into practice, would take time. And treasure chests full of time were what she needed, waiting for Ironheart to return with enough allied soldiers to confront the enemy Magus. It would not be easy. Her husband and the one-eyed dwarf calling himself Tungdil had a daunting task. Everyone knew that. Unlike the soldiers defending Evildam, Goda was not optimistic about being able to face down Lot Ionan and force him to his knees. The creature heading for the gate was walking more slowly now. It stopped three paces away and called out in a quavering voice. The guards passed on the message.
Has it brought a list of demands?
Goda asked the others.
I wonder.
The three of them hurried down. Goda, Kiras, and the Ubari went to the lift along corridors and past battlements and catapults. The open cabin took them down to ground level for the main gate. A soldier came up, a roll of parchment in his hands.
It was posted through the barrier into the spy hole, Mager, he explained.
Put it down, Goda instructed him. Carefully.
The guard looked surprised.
It's only parchment.
Do what you're told, snapped Kiras. Who knows what spell they might have put on it? It could be a trick.
The soldier did as he was ordered. Goda approached the roll and spoke a security incantation to check whether the enemy Magus had impregnated the parchment with a spell
that would start to work when it was unrolled. She relaxed when the green flickering cloud did not change colour, a sure indication that all was in order. She picked it up, unrolled it, and read.
Defenders! I, bearer of many names on this side of the abyss and beyond, demand that you surrender the fortress with immediate effect. Open the gates and withdraw. Further, I demand the entire hinterland be instantly subjected to my rule. I am inclined to be merciful if this happens without delay. If not, pity will be shown neither to the soldiers nor citizens, and I shall instruct my warriors that everything is to be destroyed. I, bearer of many names, am in possession of power beyond anything your own Magus can compete with. Your Magus should surrender to me voluntarily. If, on the other hand, I am forced to, I shall use my might to sweep him aside, and then shall have my troops wreak greater havoc still on the land. The reply to this announcement must be received within 7 sun courses, no more. If the reply is not forthcoming within the set period, I shall consider my demands to have been rejected, and I shall know how to proceed to achieve my justified claims. Nothing and no one can save you from my anger if you challenge me.
Goda handed the parchment to Kyrus. Insolent is too harmless a word for this fanatical rubbish.
Arrogant, judged the undergroundling on skimming the content. Arrogant and stupid. Someone's getting rather big for his boots today.
The Maga went to the gate and had the sentry open the spy hole. Directly in front of her, she saw the red shimmer of the sphere the foe had erected, providing cover for war engines to be moved in close. You would not make demands like that unless you had great power. There was no disputing that.
Maybe he really is that powerful.
She clutched one of the diamond splinters and prepared a spell to attack the red sphere. A narrow bolt of lightning sped through the spy hole from the tip of her middle finger. It hit the barrier. There was a humming sound like in a beehive, and then a dark colouring spread where the spell had struck. Red turned to orange, and then finally to dazzling yellow.
"Close up the spy hole," Goda commanded, stepping away from the gate.
Kyrus and the guards could no longer see what was happening on the other side, but they heard a loud explosion. The fortress gate, although reinforced with iron plates, bolts and rods, shuddered under the impact. The hinges shrieked, and flakes of rust flew off the metal. The blast was so strong that the entrance opened up a little as some of the metal fastenings fractured, flying in splinters around the heads of the defenders. The Ubari standing at Goda's side was struck and fell to the ground groaning. The undergroundling cried out and grasped her head. Shrapnel had torn off half her ear. Goda, attending to the needs of the wounded, vowed never to try an experiment like that again. It doesn't bear thinking about what would have occurred if I'd used a really strong spell. She knew now that the barrier would return any attack with 10-fold magic firepower. Girdlegard, Protectorate of Goragar, 20 miles south of the entrance to the Grey Mountains. Late winter, 6,491st to 6,492nd solar cycles. Ironheart watched the vanguard of the Black Squadron, whatever that might be, come riding out of the little valley to arrive 10 paces away from where Tungdil was standing in a dip in the landscape. He could do nothing to prevent this. He could make out ponies and dwarves with dark armor remarkably similar to that of the Invisibles. As soon as the squadron noticed the sledges, they fanned out, covering the entire breadth of the hollow. There was no way through. Tungdil halted his sledge, and the Zadar, one by one, slowed down, then dismounted, forming a circle using their shield sledges as protection to create a mini fortification, with Tungdil and Baskalin in the centre. Slin and Balindar came up and joined them.
Damn and blast! This is not going to go well.
Ironheart doubted he could reach them before the Black Squadron tightened their ring around the Zadar.
Oh, what the blazes! I'll barge my way through. Nothing on this mission is going as planned. Not even when we haven't got a plan.
He cursed under his breath and made himself as small as possible so as to offer the wind less resistance. In an audaciously dangerous maneuver, he swerved past the pony legs, headed for the last gap in the squadron's ranks, and crashed his sledge full tilt against the Zadar shield. Ironheart was hurled up into the air, then he slammed into the protective wall and slid into the snow, springing back on his feet immediately, his weapon at the ready.
"Get back!"
he yelled at the rider in front of him, but he could hardly see what he was doing, what with the melting snow dripping into his eyes.
"I swear I'll get you with my crow's beak, where it'll really hurt."
A chorus of loud laughter broke out.
"There are not many children of the smith who carry a weapon such as yours, and who are as old as you,"
someone scoffed, but still with a trace of respect in the voice. The dwarf sprang down from the saddle, chains clinking. Boindil swiftly wiped the snow off his face. Now he could see the dwarf warrior clearly. He bore a long-handled axe in his right hand. A thick mantle was worn over reinforced chainmail, and the bright red beard had black streaks in it. Green eyes surveyed Ironheart. The body was tensed, and the warrior was watching out for a surprise attack born of desperation.
"It would be a pleasure to try my strength against yours," said the unknown dwarf. "Boindil Doubleblade."
Then he turned to the Zadar.
"What's this about, Baskalin? Since when are you afraid of me and my soldiers?"
"I'm not afraid of them or of you. But I was not sure you were still their leader, Hagarin Deathbringer."
On his command, all the shields were lowered, and then Baskalin approached his friend.
"I wasn't expecting to meet you and the Desirers on my travels."
Ironheart's gaze went from one to the other.
"What, by the smith, is happening here?"
He looked at the rider's dark armor.
"Desirers?"
"They collect tribute for the Alfar from what was once Idaslain."
Balandar spoke with hearty disdain.
"Robbers and murderers, nothing more."
"Don't be so hasty."
Baskalin held out his hand to Hagarin and introduced Slin, Balindar, and Ironheart.
"Now, bend the knee before the new High King of the Dwarflands," he announced dramatically, "for he is one of your own, a thirdling. Tungdil Goldhand!"
Hagarin took a step back in surprise and stared at the one-eyed dwarf emerging from the ranks of the Zadar. Then his gaze took in the armor and bloodthirster, and finally the hard facial features. He saw the insignia of a High King.
"Well, I'll be..."
His voice trailed off in disbelief, then he sank onto one knee and bowed his head, proffering Tungdil his axe. The Black Squadron dismounted, and 150 warriors, male and female, all made their reverences to the ruler of all dwarves. Ironheart looked around with a grin.
"If this happens every 10 miles or so all the way to Jon Bara, we'll soon have a decent army to put the wind up the Alfar and chuck them out of Girdlygard," he laughed. "Scholar, will you take a look at this? Thirdlings showing you respect."
Tungdil commanded Hagarin and his squadron to stand.
"If I understand, Baskalin, and yourself correctly, may I assume you share the same views on the Alfar?"
Hagarin glanced at the satrap, who nodded permission to continue.
"Lord, many of us have been waiting for you to return to lead your tribe against all the enemies."
As he spoke, he seemed radiant with delight.
"You don't know it, but our folk recount legends about your fame.
Tungdil looked at Baskelin, who shrugged, and said,
I haven't had time to tell you. This will make a good story for the campfire.
Ironheart gave a broad grin.
So, my scholar, a fairy tale hero fated by the Thirdlings now.
If he's so popular with the Thirdlings, this gives us untold opportunities, remarked Slynn.
Not all revere him,
Hargrim was quick to point out.
But very, very many do.
He beamed at Tungdil.
One of the legends describes your heroic deeds on the far side of the Black Abyss. When I see you wearing this armor, it feels like it was a prophecy. The story describes you exactly like this.
Baskelin gave two of his Zadar orders to watch the sky for any signs of the Cordrian's approach.
We need to find ourselves somewhere nice and quiet where we can talk properly, he suggested. Have you got a place near here, old friend?
Hargrim nodded. Half an orbit's ride away. It's one of my fortresses. Let's harness our ponies to your sledges and make for the stronghold.
Is it strong enough to withstand a Cordrian attack?
Hargrim's expression did not change.
It can hold up for a good while at least. And if the tower were to collapse, we can still escape through the tunnels.
He looked at Baskelin.
What have you been up to? Why is the beast after you?
The satrap laughed.
We'll tell you later. Take the High King to your home and look after us well. Then we'll have time to talk.
He became serious.
You will have to come to a decision about whom to serve, he said, suddenly formal.
I did that many cycles ago.
The Thirdling bowed to Tungdil.
Whatever leads you to the land of the Alfar, from now on, I and the Black Squadron shall serve only you, sire. You will bring us glory, as our legends promise.
Balin-Dar rolled his eyes. But a happy Slynn, on the other hand, appeared gratified.
Absolutely charming.
Charming sounds feminine. But I certainly find it all extraordinary.
Ironheart was pleased that instead of the battle he had been fearing, they were now celebrating with their new brothers in arms. But he could not shrug off his disquiet at the amount of black there was around him. It was like a weather front of gathering thunderclouds. Would it discharge itself into a terrible storm? If so, it was clear that at its very eye would be standing none other than his friend Tungdil.
It will suck us all in, he said under his breath, remembering that he too would soon be donning the dark armor of the Zadar. Fracas, don't let me turn into one of them just because I have to wear their black plating.
Again, it was Slynn who overheard. This fourthling had highly developed hearing.
You're afraid you might become like them. Boindil, it's only black steel we're going to be putting on.
He tapped himself on the chest, then touched his head.
Our hearts and minds will still belong to us. Look on it as a harmless disguise.
He threw one end of a rope to one of the riders. The other was tied to his sledge.
If you like, I'll look after you, my poor little dwarf.
Ironheart laughed.
You're right to make fun of my childish thoughts.
He got his sledge ready. Pulled swiftly across the snow, they soon learned the disadvantages of this mode of travel. The ponies' hooves kicked up the snow and whirled icy clouds into their faces, such that, before long, they'd all taken on the appearance of small, grim, bearded snowmen. Through the snow, Ironheart saw the 20-pace-high curtain wall loom up in front. He also saw blasphemous insults daubed on it that would make any decent dwarf shudder in his boots. This was nothing less than pure hatred of Vrakus in the form of runes. The symbols swore total annihilation of all the tribes. Shameful slogans daubed on many of the blocks of stone. Vrakus the cripple, Vrakus the powerless, Vrakus the impotent. Ironheart was not the only one to notice.
"I'm not setting foot in there,"
cried Slynn, and Balindar nodded in agreement.